Today at Reader's Corner, Washington Post reporter Joby Warrick, author of Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. These days, the terrorist organization known as ISIS has much of the world on high alert. How this happened is the subject of a book by today's guest, Washington Post reporter Joby Warrick. In Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS, Mr. Warrick traces the history of ISIS back to its founder, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. During the Iraq War, Zarqawi managed to turn a couple dozen misfits, extremists and thugs, in a Jordanian prison into a terrorist army that is again thriving. Today, ISIS is continuing to spread its brand of militant Islam and has claimed responsibility for terrorist acts in a growing number of countries. Today, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Joby Warrick. He won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for Black Flags, and the book is now out in paperback. Mr. Warrick also is the author of The Triple Agent, about the Camp Chapman attack in Afghanistan in December of 2009, which resulted in the murder of seven CIA employees by a suicide bomber. Mr. Warrick joined the Washington Post national staff in 1996. He has covered national security, the Middle East, and the environment, and currently writes about terrorism. Mr. Warrick joins us from the studios of the Washington Post for this interview. Joby Warrick, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be with you.
So, Joby, tell us how you dug into the Muslim holy text and came up with this title, Black Flags. What's that all about?
Black flags, it's really an important symbol, and we're all used to seeing these flags whenever you see ISIS and its propaganda reels. But it's really very important to them because they want to claim that they're the heirs to this caliphate, this almost mythical Muslim society that they're claiming to build. And this flag is a powerful symbol of it, and the colors and the writing on it go back to the times of the early prophets. And so by raising this banner, they not only have a symbol that they recognize, but it's something that resonates to Muslims around the world, so they think they have something there. There's also a passage in the Hadith, and that's kind of a collection of religious writings, not the Quran, but other holy scriptures that many Muslims regard as sacred, that talks about this future time when these men with black flags and long hair and beards with their names connected to their hometowns, these people will come riding from the east and do be this great army. And that's who they see themselves as being, and that's what they're trying to pull off right now.
And I did pick up on that part about their surnames taken from their hometowns. I mean, isn't that exactly the story of al-Zarqawi? And if so, that's a little bit of a messianic message there.
Exactly. Each one has this name that Zarqawi means from Zarqa, which is a city in Jordan. And so a lot of them use this combination of it's called a kunya, but it's an Arab name, which is Abu, which means, father of, and then a son, which might be a real son or a real daughter, or it might be some homage to some historical figure. But it's everything, even their names are symbolic to them and suggesting ambitions beyond just terrorism. They really want to take over territory and they want to change the world.
Getting back to the basics, I guess, your book, of course, is subtitled The Rise of ISIS. President Obama says ISIL all the time. What's the deal? Why do we have two different pronunciations of the same organization?
Yeah, and that's a good question because some people think there's maybe they're hiding something by using ISIL instead of ISIS or not acknowledging some part of this group's agenda. But it actually all goes to the L part, which really it's they call themselves something that transliterates to the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, which is kind of this ancient region which includes what is now the Levant. So when people talk about ISIL, they're basically essentially talking about an entire region, not just Syria proper, because these guys don't recognize states like Syria and Jordan or Iraq as existing, because to them it's this one giant area that used to be part of the caliphate. And so They're erasing those old boundaries just with the name of the organization.
Yeah, these are Western labels that have been imposed on them
right, to
a large extent.
Exactly.
So let's talk about Zarqawi. And first of all, could you refresh our memory as to when he was taken out, what happened to him? And then we'll go back and explore a bit about his history.
He was kind of public enemy number one for the U.S. During the Iraq War. And if anyone has seen the movie American Sniper, depicts part of the effort to try to kill or capture Zarqawi's people. We finally got him in 2006, took him out with an airstrike, and that we hoped was kind of the beginning of the end for this entire movement. And of course, we were wrong about that.
So tell us about his background. I know he dropped out of high school. What was his history as a younger man? And I know somewhere in your book you referred to his mother's perspective on her terrorist son.
Yeah, she said, you know, after he becomes famous, reporters are coming around to her house and asking about him. And you know, it was this terrorist, is he doing all these things? And she kind of laughed and said, he's not that smart. And that kind of struck me as funny, but it was actually true. This is somebody who's probably the least likely person to lead a terrorist organization because he didn't even finish high school. He was a dropout. He got into crime early. He was a thug. He had tattoos, a heavy drinker, just sort of the opposite of the kind of holy warrior figure that he later became. But, you know, he was underestimated his entire life, including when he started a terrorist movement in Iraq that nobody really expected to accomplish very much. But they ended up being this huge force behind the insurgency that kept us pinned down in Iraq for many years.
Now, he wound up in a Jordanian prison. He is Jordanian, but tell us about what happens to him in this prison and how he develops his leadership skills from there.
He's an interesting character. So when he comes back, he had a couple of formative experiences. One was running off to fight the Russians and the Afghans in the Afghan Civil War. Comes back kind of with his head full of ideology and things he wants to do, and he starts a cell and he starts going after small time symbols of Western corruption, like video, like pornographic theaters and liquor stores and things like that. And there's this one real funny episode where one of his comrades goes into a pornographic theater to blow the place up, gets so engrossed in the film he forgets about his bomb. So he's literally sitting there, you know, mesmerized when the bomb blows up and actually blows off his legs and doesn't hurt anybody else. But because of this kind of activity, he gets picked up by the Jordanians and they put him in jail and they send him away for what should have been a very long time. He's sentenced to 15 years in prison as a young man and just sort of disappears into this pretty harsh place and probably never to be seen again.
Now, he does in this prison meet up with some people who would become his allies in the Islamic movement, isn't that correct?
Right, and so here is where it's another part of his transformation, because it is a pretty harsh place, but all these Islamists are corralled together. So you've got some other guys who were kind of wannabe terrorists and others who are thinkers and planners, and within that group, he becomes a leader. He's a tough guy. He's got military experience. He's got big ideas and ambitions, and so this core of extreme Islamists start to gel around him, and he becomes, by default, the leader.
So how does he get out of prison? That didn't exactly work the way it was planned.
Right. So this is one of the a few amazing breaks that Zarqawi gets in his career. He's supposed to stay in jail till 2009. But instead, in 1999, 10 years before that, the king of Jordan, King Hussein, dies. And there's a tradition in Jordan where the death of the king results in the granting of a general amnesty. So mostly political prisoners end up getting freed. In this case, the tribes and the parliament all put together a list of pretty much everybody they could think of they wanted to spring from jail. And so 2,000 prisoners get released all at once, and among them are Zarqawi and all of his followers. And so just by quirk of fate, he ends up getting out of jail much earlier than anyone thought, and then he heads right off to Afghanistan to do some more bad things.
Now, the United States apparently aided and abetted Zarqawi when it comes to his brand, when it comes to how well he was known. Help us understand how that happened.
Yeah, so you've got a figure, really, who's not regarded very highly by anyone. And in fact, Al-Qaeda doesn't like him at all. Zarqawi ends up going to Al-Qaeda's camp and tries to join up with Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden didn't want to have anything to do with him, because he's just considered too much of a hothead, he's hard to contain or control, so they kind of push him off. But when he does get a break is right before the Iraq War starts, the invasion in 2003, the Bush administration gets this idea that Zarqawi is part of this connection between Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi president, and Al-Qaeda, and they actually put his picture on the screen before the United Nations Security Council in 2003, arguing that this is this dangerous nexus that we have to stop and we have to invade Iraq to take care of this possible connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Turns out it wasn't true at all, but overnight, just by putting his name so prominently in front of the entire world, Zarqawi becomes very famous, and almost overnight he starts getting recruits and money and just becomes, this international figure because we made him one.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Washington Post reporter Joby Warrick, author of Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. Now, Secretary of State Powell played a role in this as well in his UN speech, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So this is, you know, if you look back at that speech, and it's fascinating to see now, you know, Powell talks about Zarqawi specifically for several minutes, and he, you know, sort of drops innuendo after another, suggesting that this is a, you know, sinister figure that is somehow connected with Iraqi intelligence. And to his credit, Colin Powell since then has tried to walk away from that and said that it's one of the big mistakes of his career was to make that speech, because a lot of the things they alleged at the time, even the CIA had serious questions about. They didn't think that connection was there, but the Bush administration felt it had to use that little bits of evidence, flimsy as it was, to try to you know, garner world support for an invasion of Iraq, which happened just a couple of months afterward.
I think you even pointed out in the book that Powell's speech was actually given to him. It's not like he and his staff sat down and wrote it. It was given to him for that particular purpose at the UN.
Yeah, exactly. He had he was handed initially a much harsher indictment, you know, making allegations about connections between Al-Qaeda and Saddam that the CIA just would not back, because they just felt they were based on hearsay and, you know, unreliable sources and that kind of thing. So instead, this speech that Colin Powell eventually read was cobbled together with the help from CIA analysts trying to use, you know, salvage bits of the file that they had that they thought would stick. And, you know, everybody knew that Zarqawi was probably a bad guy, but where they really made a leap was to suggest that somehow he was in Saddam Hussein's pocket, and that Saddam was going to help him carry out some attack against the West, and that was certainly not going to happen.
How did Zarqawi use the U.S. invasion of Iraq to build his terrorist army?
So here's a guy, here's again where he had real vision, because, you know, when the U.S. invades Iraq in March 2003, you know, bin Laden's not there, Al-Qaeda proper is not there, but Zarqawi very smartly anticipated this battle was going to happen. He told friends before the invasion, this is where the sort of the showdown is going to take place. This is my destiny. I'm going to fight the Americans, and I'm going to do it in Iraq. So he was present with his small group of followers at the time, you know, moved into Baghdad and essentially started to set up shop, making alliances, you know, basically befriending some of these unemployed Iraqi soldiers and political officials to create what became the core of his group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
You know, before we leave this part of the interview, I want to touch on a CIA agent by the name of Neda Bakos, because we were talking a little bit about the fact that we have a situation here where it's a question of whether or not Zarqawi has an Al-Qaeda tie. And the White House, at least Cheney and some of the Bush staff, are trying as hard as they can to make this connection. But in the meantime, the CIA analyst is sitting over in Langley just amazed and somewhat shocked. Give us the story on what she understood to be Zarqawi's relationship with Al-Qaeda. And you've mentioned it a little already, but again, I just want to bring in the CIA intelligence here and how apparently the White House just chose to ignore it.
Right. And this woman, she's really fascinating. And her name is Neda, as you said. And she was a relatively junior officer at the time, but she was in charge of the Zarqawi file. And later on, she becomes the person most responsible for going after Zarqawi. But she's looking at the raw intelligence. She's looking at the reports that the agency is producing about Zarqawi. And they clearly see he's a troubled guy. He's got, you know, he's a potential problem for us. But they're looking very closely to see if there's any connection with Saddam Hussein. And they're not seeing any of it. And so she's there watching the UN speech that Powell's giving, and she's just mortified because there's a sort of cherry-picking of intelligence, sort of lumping together, you know, circumstantial arguments to try to make this guy into this connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. She knew it wasn't true, and they're pushing back as hard as they can, but eventually that's the case that the Bush administration tries to make.
What evidence, loose as it might be, did the White House actually use as this so-called missing link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda?
So they were looking for somebody that was, you know, very conveniently in Iraq, and Zarqawi actually was, because when he did move into Afghanistan, bin Laden sent him to the other end of the country and really didn't want anything to do with him. But after Afghanistan falls in 2002, when we push out Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, he takes off and heads into the mountains between Iraq and Iran. So he's physically in Iraq, but he's in the Kurdish area, you know, above the no-fly zone, an area where Saddam Hussein Hussein isn't free to operate, where he can't get his aircraft. And so it's kind of a little safe zone that they've created, the terrorists have created for themselves. But he was physically in Iraq, and that made some Americans suspicious. Well, he must be controlled. You know, Saddam Hussein is somehow tolerating his presence, probably working together with him. They had heard that he had traveled to Baghdad to get medical attention, and they assumed that, well, he couldn't have done that without the Iraqi intelligence services knowing about it. Well, truth is that the Iraqi intelligence folks weren't that good, and there were people going in and out of the country and moving around without anyone knowing about it. And he was trying to hide from the Iraqis as much as he was trying to hide from us. He wanted very much not to be associated with them and not to be caught by them.
So the opening pages of your book walks us through a series of hotel bombings in Amman, Jordan, in 2005. Why was Jordan such an early target for ISIS? And, of course, it's remained so.
It has, because Jordan is, everything about Jordan is an irritant, and particularly to Zarqawi, because he was a Jordanian, and he saw his own country, his own government, as being an illegitimate state. He didn't think Jordan was supposed to exist, essentially created by the victorious colonial or Western powers after World War I, just sort of, you know, drawn up on a map. Here's a country called Jordan, and so that's how it came into existence. It has a secular or more secular government that's been pro-Western for most of its existence, and the biggest horror to these guys was it made peace with Israel. King Hussein, you know, had a peace treaty with the Israeli government, and that has been an unforgivable sin to some of these Islamists. And so they would like to see Jordan punished, and they really would like to see Jordan wiped out and no longer exist.
So to the extent that today we can look back and see that the U.S. invasion of Iraq really did develop ISIS and allow it to prosper and grow, the Jordanian king, on the other hand, was warning the United States about this. Tell us about his advice to the United States, and I believe also he tried to give some advice to Saddam Hussein that he tried to work with?
He's been kind of the man in the middle ever since he came to power in 1999, you know, having to really operate in a difficult region. One of the ones that he tried to help early on was actually the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad.
That's right, the Syrian president.
So you have Arab Spring starting. It's his real, kind of the world is turning upside down for many of these Arab governments. You know, the Egyptian president falls, Libya falls, Syria starts to have this violent uprising, and so King Abdullah, you know, very smartly tried to get ahead of this movement in his country, and he pushed for a lot of reforms that he wanted to do anyway. He tried to make the parliament much more democratic and tried to loosen restrictions to make the country more of a parliamentary democracy. But he's looking across the border, and he sees his neighbor, Assad, is doing the opposite and is using all kinds of brutal means to try to put down these rebellions. And so he calls up Assad personally and says, you know, this is the wrong approach. You need to reach out to your people. You need to reform. And Assad basically told him to mind your own business, and he could proceed to clamp down even harder and become even more brutal. And that was really where the civil war began and where ISIS saw an opportunity to move into Syria and become what it is today.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Joby Warrick about his recent book, Black Flags. Mr. Warrick is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and his book looks at the rise of the terrorist organization ISIS. So the current leadership of ISIS is al-Baghdadi, or however you pronounce his name. Help us with how the current leadership of ISIS has changed, if it has at all, from the leadership under al-Zarqawi.
The current leadership very much takes its cue from the Zarqawi model. So a lot of the things that Zarqawi innovated and started to do back in the 2000s, they're doing today, but on a greater scale. In 2004, Zarqawi kidnapped a young American man, a young man from Philadelphia named Nick Berg, put him in an orange jumpsuit, put him in front of a video camera, and then Zarqawi himself cut the young man's head off. And that's the spectacle that we see ISIS, you know, play out again and again and again. But it really all started with Zarqawi and this idea that any horrific act of terrorism is amplified many times over by the internet, by using social media to sort of broadcast these horrific images. And there's also nothing more disturbing to people than an intimate execution of a single individual, much more so than even a bombing or a mass shooting. And so Zarqawi played that to great effect, and you see ISIS doing it, you know, and just on a larger scale and amplifying it even more because they have access to social media that didn't even exist in Zarqawi's time.
So President Obama came into office promising to get U.S. soldiers home and the U.S. out of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's the next goal of the next president? I mean, what happens next? How do we defeat ISIS?
Yeah, this is the challenge of our age. I think it's taken us a long time as a country to really wake up to the ISIS threat. I think there's a war fatigue in this country, and it's quite understandable. We don't want to get involved in another Middle East conflict, and we shouldn't be in any Iraq sense. We shouldn't be there, I think, with hundreds of thousands of troops and making ourselves the issue and the target. But we were also slow to recognize that ISIS would become the international threat that it is. We were almost willing to see it as being a regional problem and something that that the Middle East would have to deal with, but not something that had the reach to touch Western countries, including our own. That turns out to be a false assumption. They very much have ambitions to attack places around the world, and so we do have to defeat them, and it's going to be a very long and very difficult process.
Well, the Iraq War was the costliest U.S. military campaign since Vietnam. Will there be any let up as far as that's concerned? I mean, this is still going to be a very costly endeavor, no matter how we take it on, I would assume.
Yeah, one would hope that not as much, because the key things are absolutely essential to eliminate this caliphate, because their ability to claim territory in Iraq and Syria, to have a capital from which they pretend to govern, is a powerful symbol for them, and it kind of creates or adds to this mythology that's formed around ISIS as being this unstoppable force. You know, they're righting the wrongs of centuries of abuses against Muslims in their mythology, and so this all kind of is wrapped up into this caliphate they've built. And so getting rid of that caliphate, denying them the ability to say that they have this safe haven in Syria from which they can plan attacks across the rest of the world, that has to be job one, and we're making some progress with that. You see that ISIS is losing territory. It's under heavy pressure in Syria and Iraq right now, and there's serious talk about a military campaign to take back Mosul, which is the second largest Iraqi city, and it's now in ISIS's hands. Once that's done, though, that's not the end of it, because ISIS has spread to other places. They have significant cells in Libya and Yemen and other countries, and of course they have a cadre now of thousands of young men and women who've been trained by ISIS and have been sent to other countries to potentially do mischief elsewhere.
There's a section in your book where you talk about, you walk us through a discussion Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, CIA Director Petraeus, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, all arguing for arming a moderate rebel army that could overthrow the regime of President Assad of Syria, and President Obama declines. What role does that play in this overall ISIS issue?
Yeah, it was really one of those moments when you look at it now and it just, you can see that history could have gone either way. There was no great eagerness in the administration by, I think, anyone to get involved in another Middle Eastern war. But a number of officials, and Hillary Clinton was one of them, and so was Petraeus and Panetta, as you mentioned, began to worry about some of the groups that they were seeing coming into Syria and setting up camp, particularly ISIS, but some other really bad people too. And so they began to argue that, look, we can't let this war continue on indefinitely. Assad has to go. We've said that. But the Syrian rebels aren't strong enough to make this happen. We should help tip the scales a little bit. So there was a number of individuals that lobbied pretty hard for aid to moderate rebel groups to try to help them defeat Assad and then take control of the country. Who knows, looking back, whether that would have worked. Obama had his reservations about it. He was thinking that getting involved even on that relatively small scale would suck us into a larger conflict. We've been occupying the country and with all kinds of bad outcomes. But others look at this and say, if we would just had put a little bit more into this effort and help some of the good guys in Syria take control of that country, maybe ISIS wouldn't have been able to come and create this awful monster that we see in Syria and in Iraq right now.
Without a doubt, one of the things that clearly stirred the passions of the West and prompted the leaders of the West to take ISIS seriously was the beheadings. Mm-hmm. James Foley, the photojournalist, Nick Berg, the killing of Lawrence Foley. Is there anything going on inside ISIS that recognizes that was an overreaction? I mean, even Al-Qaeda didn't approve of Zarqawi's methods. Is there anything within ISIS going on that suggests we need to back off of this beheading policy, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, it's really, I think, one of the hardest things for those of us here in the West to put our heads around, because to think that any individuals can, first of all, commit these kinds of atrocities just seems to be something so evil that it's beyond comprehension. But, you know, for them to not only do that, but then to somehow think that is a good thing for them politically in terms of the propaganda, is just, you shake your head when you look at it. The truth is, back to Zarqawi's time, there was a sense that extreme violence works for them. They're not looking to be loved so much as they're looking to sow fear. Fear is a weapon that intimidates potential adversaries. You know, when they take over areas, nobody wants to fight ISIS because they know what the consequences are. And around the world, you know, those kinds of shocking images actually appeal to a certain hardcore group of followers that they most want to attract. So it's really all about being feared, not being loved. And they found this to be a very effective calling card for them. Every now and then, you'll actually see someone within ISIS. We see these conversations that go on and over Twitter or in social media with some leaders saying, you know, we should dial back a little bit. This is a bit extreme. Some things we're doing is, let's just move it back a notch or two. And yet they persist the next day at doing something even more horrific. So this really seems to be, you know, central to ISIS's image of itself. It's what has worked for them in the past, but it's actually created a lot of enemies for them. And you look at opinion polls today in the Muslim world, you know, favorability for ISIS had been, you know, maybe in the high single digits or even higher in some countries. Now it is almost non-existent. It's like 1 or 2% will profess that they support ISIS because they're all turned off by these terrible things they do.
I was really impressed with the fast turnaround of your book, because it seemed like it got right up there to just a matter of months ago. But obviously, there was a publisher's date, and things continue to unfold in the Middle East and with ISIS. Is there anything that's happened since you've written your book where it's like, whoa, would I like to put one final chapter on that, or put something into the paperback edition that I didn't have a chance to cover in this one? Anything?
Yeah, that is a good question. I think I had to decide pretty early on that I was never going to be able to capture the unfolding, you know, history of ISIS, because clearly that's going to be a story that we'll have with us for months and maybe years to come. So this was going to be a story about the origins and how the thing got started, and that was my focus. But I think the one thing that has surprised me is I did not expect to see ISIS's ambitions become so global so quickly, because we really did see them being preoccupied with building this caliphate, and you know, they were going to be brutal and tough, but essentially just to keep everybody out of their business, and they were going to create this little homeland for themselves and try to be successful that way. But very quickly, we've seen them turn and have ambitions outside the region. And I think what we're going to see in the months ahead is that the more pressure they face in Syria, you know, the tougher they're going to be, and the more they want to strike out against, you know, the targets of you know, in the West, just to show themselves as being relevant and strong. And so I think that's part of the sort of the next chapter of ISIS that we're seeing unfold right now.
I'd be surprised if I didn't know the answer to this last question, but I have to ask it anyway. Trump at some point commented on the need for us to go after the families of terrorists, and I believe there was a question of whether that was actually a war crime statement. That has to inflame ISIS and increase its membership, wouldn't it?
You know, the sad thing, when you hear statements like that, regardless of what people think of Trump personally, it has a really devastating effect in the region. And you see leaders like Abdullah in Jordan and others who are, you know, really trying to hold back this, you know, had their fingers in the dike and are really fighting for their own survival. And they're trying very hard not to make this a fight against, you know, of Muslims versus the rest of the world. What we need to have is to have Muslims on our side, and for American politicians to go around saying that we're going to kill innocent members of terrorist families, or to say that we're going to ban any Muslims from entering the country just because of their religion, or shutting down their mosques, or carding them somehow, that directly feeds into ISIS's narrative, which is that this is a, you know, fight of the crusaders against Islam, and it makes the job of defeating these guys, containing them, that much harder.
Joby, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
I really enjoyed this. Thanks for the time.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Joby Warrick. Next week, Kadi Martin, author of True Believer, Stalin's Last American Spy. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.